This episode of Gunblog Variety Cast brought to you by LawOfSelfDefense.com. Go to LawOfSelfDefense.com/variety to learn about your state's self-defense laws. Sign up for one of their online or in-person seminars or buy the book Law of Self-Defense and get 10% off when you use the discount code VARIETY at checkout. That's LawOfSelfDefense.com/variety. Sit back, relax, and take a ride with us on the Gunblog Variety Cast, episode 56. Welcome back to the Gunblog Variety Cast. I'm your host, Sean from NC Gunblog, and with me today is Adam from Guns, Cars, Tech Blog. How are you doing, Adam?
Better than I deserve. How are you doing, Sean?
Not bad. Well, the Tactical Dog and Fitness Report. 23 dog walking miles, and Dice has got towel time last night. Best walk ever.
Towel time?
Yeah, that's when she gets wet, and somebody has to wipe her off with a towel.
Oh. So Tactical Dog has like this whole routine, and she like runs in between my legs while she's getting dried off with the towel. And yeah, she loves it. And then my wife will take her out when it's raining. And Tactical Dog will do that to my wife while she's wearing like a skirt and knock her over.
Whoops. Yeah, I got about halfway through the half mile walk last night and it started raining. I thought, I'll just stand underneath these trees until it... Yeah, that didn't work.
No.
I came home soaked. And Dice thought it was the best day ever because towel time.
Yay, water day. Kids are like that too, by the way. So I haven't done a Couch to 5K update in a really long time because I haven't been running because kids make me want to die or something. I don't know. It's really hard to like want to get up and run 3 miles in the morning when you've already been up four times since midnight. But I have been walking on those days. So I'm not a total slob, mostly.
Yeah, I've been walking too, but I am a total slob at this point. I've gotten fat.
But I've been walking like 10 miles a week, and you've been walking, so you did 23 miles this week. So there's that.
And now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Aaron Paulette. Today, Aaron's going to talk about building a survival e-reader.
Come on, every pony. It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Aaron Paulette.
Hey, Aaron. What exciting preparational preparitude do you have for us today?
Okay, I suppose it's like an operational operator who operates operationally.
In addition to being the bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, you're also like Auntie Aaron, the prepper aunt. We all look to you for the most amazing, exciting, neat, very inexpensive ways to hack our way to safety and... you know, live through dangerous things. So what are you going to tell us about today?
Well, last podcast's plug of the week about your Kindle Fire inspired me to talk about how to make a survival e-reader.
You're kidding, right? My Kindle is a survival tool.
You have a Kindle Fire HD 6, right?
Mm-hmm.
That comes with 8 gigabytes of memory. You probably have access to only 6 for storage. The average e-book is about 500 kilobytes. So 6 gigs is roughly 600,000 kilobytes. So that's about 1,000 to 1,200 ebooks you could store. Now, your options increase if you have a Barnes & Noble Nook instead. They have slots for micro SD cards, in which case you can just expand that storage space massively. Amazon has 64 gig micro SDs for about $20. Now, your Kindle cost you only $114. Whereas the cheapest version of the newest Nook, the 7.0, cost about $150, so you pay for that versatility. But if you don't mind getting an older model, a Nook from 2012 will only cost you about $50. Ultimately, the main difference between the Kindle and the Nook are file types. Nook uses the very common EPUB format, while Kindle uses its proprietary Mobi format, which is mostly popular because it's on Amazon. Fortunately, there's a way to convert one to the other on your home computer. You just follow the link in the show notes below. So what can you do with all of this storage? Well, you create a survival library of ebooks that can teach you first aid, or help you identify plants and animals, or show you how to do any number of other things. And the wonderful thing about these readers is that they can show you what to do using full color pictures rather than simply telling you through words. And sometimes that makes all the difference. For example, edible plants look different in the winter than they do in the summer, and a good ebook will show you both pictures. And what's more, there are plenty of ebooks about prepping and survival that are absolutely free. I've included a link to a webpage for that. Now, I do want to caution people about using apps. There are many apps that do similar things, like do first aid or have survival information, and they do have the benefit of being interactive. However, apps often take up more room than ebooks. You need the memory to run the program, not just read from a file. And many have a tendency to not work without an internet connection. But sometimes these are fine, so be sure not to dismiss them out of hand. Just investigate before you invest.
Oh, come on, Aaron. My Kindle's fragile. It needs power. And what if it gets wet? I mean, aren't regular books better?
Well, these are good points, but you're fragile too. You'll break if dropped from a great height, just like a Kindle. And you need a light to read a regular book. Your e-reader makes its own light. And yes, an e-reader that gets wet is likely broken, but a book that gets wet has pages that can tear, or stick together, or become moldy. The fact of the matter is that ebooks and regular books both have a place in a bug-out bag. Your Kindle weighs as much as one book, but can hold the information of over 1,000. That's not a bad weight-to-value ratio. Now, yes, you will need to take care of it, just like any other piece of gear. Fortunately, there's an entire industry dedicated to creating waterproof and shockproof tablet cases. Just yesterday, I was in the sporting goods section of Walmart and found a lockable waterproof plastic case shaped for an iPad, and it was filled with that pluckable foam so you could create a custom cushion. And this was around $20, which is not a bad investment for an expensive tablet. Now yes, you are going to need to power it. Fortunately, most e-readers can be powered by solar or by crank, just like a cell phone can, so any cell phone recharging strategies work for them too. The problem is that most of these are trickle-charged, so you're looking at a lot of cranking or many hours in sunlight. Now for this, I would recommend getting a USB-based battery that can charge your tablet while you sleep, and then recharge that battery during the day. I've included my recommendations for solar panels, batteries, and crank chargers in the show notes. And even if the worst happens and your Kindle or Nook breaks, you can still make use of it by taking it apart and using the pieces. For example, the battery can be used to start fires, the circuit boards can be turned into cutting tools, and you can use the back of the LCD screen as a signal mirror. So you see, Sean, it makes a lot of sense to have an e-reader in a bug-out bag. Just make sure to take care of it.
And when I'm bored, I can just read a book for entertainment.
Or listen to music, or watch a movie. Yes, morale is an important part of survival, and anything that makes your life better and takes your mind off boredom or miserable conditions is worthwhile.
All right, Aaron. It was good to talk with you. See you again next week.
See ya. Take care.
If you'd like to read more from Aaron, check out her blog, lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com. Felons behaving badly. Suspect shot in home break-in has criminal history.
This is my shocked face.
Dateline Charlotte, North Carolina. A man came home Wednesday to find two people inside his home and shot them, Charlotte Mecklenburg police said in a news release. Suspect 1, who was out on probation and has a criminal history, was shot and later hospitalized. Suspect 1 and Suspect 2 were inside the Maryvale Lane home in the middle of the afternoon when the owner caught them in the act, police said. The owner opened fire, hitting Suspect 1, who drove off and later crashed his vehicle at a nearby intersection, where he was taken to a hospital with life-threatening injuries. Neighbors tipped off police and called 911, leading to Suspect 2's arrest. So why don't we let WSOC-TV tell you all about suspect number one.
We did some digging and found has a long criminal past, starting with larceny when he was 16. He's been charged with larceny 8 times, breaking and entering 7 times. And it turns out the 26-year-old was out on probation for a felony breaking and entering charge when he was shot. Now he's in the hospital with life-threatening injuries.
Once again, the "but this is a quiet neighborhood" argument gets trotted out. Nicole Christine Iverson watched it all unfold on Wednesday. "It was just such a surprise," Iverson said. "It's generally such a quiet neighborhood." She has lived in the nearby home for 3 years. "The most exciting thing that has ever happened in this neighborhood is vandalism of cars out front," Iverson said.
Yeah, if there's regularly vandalism of cars out front, you don't live in such a quiet neighborhood.
Well, you know what? Just because the people who live in the neighborhood are nice people doesn't mean there's a fence that repels bad people.
Also true.
So, he was arrested 8 times. Let's look at his conviction record. Larceny of a motor vehicle, 1-5-2005, felon class H. Larceny of a motor vehicle, 5-19-2005, felon class H. Operate a vehicle without a license, 5-19-2005, misdemeanor class 2. Possessing stolen goods, 5-19-2005, felon class H. Reckless driving, 5-19-2005, misdemeanor class 2. Speeding to elude arrest, 5-19-2005, felon class H.
That was an exciting day.
Was for him. Breaking and entering vehicles, 5-27-2009, felon class H. Felony breaking and entering, 5-27-2009, felon class H. Breaking and entering vehicles, 5-28-2009, felon class H. Felony breaking and entering, 5-28-2009, felon class H. Felony breaking and entering, 9-25-2010, felon class H. Breaking and entering, 4-22-2011, felon class H. Larceny after breaking and entering, 4-22-2011, felon class H. Larceny of a motor vehicle, 4-22-2011, felon class H. Larceny of a motor vehicle attempted, 4-22-2011, felon class H. Felony breaking and entering attempted, 11-12-2012, felon class I. Conspiracy, 12-5-2012, felon class I. And conspiracy again, 12-9-2012, felon class I. Not a very successful criminal.
No, he gets caught a lot.
And note the ages.
Yeah, this goes back 10 years, and he's 26 now.
Yeah.
I'm sure it goes back further.
Even if it doesn't, there's a track record right there. He's not going to change.
No.
This week in Foreign Policy for Grownups, Nikki tells us how wrong she was about the European migrant crisis. Nikki, it seems like a lot of Americans weren't paying attention to the European migrant crisis last week when you talked about it, but all of a sudden it's becoming a big deal. How come?
Oh, well, that's easy. Remember when I said last week that this could become a national security issue for the United States because of the State Department's visa waiver program, possibly allowing like thousands of EU processed and legal migrants to enter this country freely?
Yeah.
Well, I was wrong. Much wrong. I was a fail, actually. It's not the visa waiver program that's the problem. It is now the usual suspects. The EU, the UN, etc., demanding that the United States start taking in thousands of these Syrian refugees, because we apparently don't have problems of our own, right? The problem is, as I said last week, is that the EU can't afford this flood of migrants. They have to process them, they have to house them, they have to try and put them to work. They're a huge resource drain. And you know what? For people who just escaped genocide, they're awfully entitled. Just recently, an angry mob of asylum seekers broke through police lines near Hungary's southern border with Serbia, the same border where Hungary was stationing troops, and began marching north toward Budapest. Now look, I understand some of these people are desperate. I get it. But at the same time, I have to wonder, what is it that makes them so entitled to bust through the border of a nation where they're obviously quite not welcome? How do I know they're not welcome? Barbed wire fence and armed soldiers. That's how I know. But apparently these people are entitled. They're entitled to food, shelter, and an existence in a nation that quite obviously does not want them. And busting into someone's home and squatting there demanding services isn't going to endear them to anyone. Look, my parents waited years to be allowed to enter the United States. We were Jews. We were persecuted like you wouldn't believe back in the Soviet Union. We literally escaped the USSR. But you know what? We certainly didn't just bust through the gates and demand to be allowed in. But I digress. So now, because the EU can't handle its own border problems, and because they're incapable of handling the large influx of refugees, and because they're too spineless to actually say no, they're now demanding that the United States take them. And the demands are growing ever more shrill. The UN is screeching about a global response. You know what that means? Here, Americans, you take them. The progressive site Vox is sniveling about them nasty, racist, rich countries refusing to take the poor little brown people. An online petition from the progtards at moveon.org also urges the United States to just randomly open its doors. Presidential candidate Martin O'Malley, yeah, I know who. He's running for what? So he's trying to be relevant and demand that we welcome 65,000 Syrian refugees into this country because, I don't know, compassion or something.
So aside from the housing, processing, you know, those sort of costs, what's the problem?
Well, because that's not a big enough issue in and of itself, right? Remember last week I spoke about the security threats associated with fake passports and that a black market in Syrian passports is flourishing? Well, guess what? There's a security threat. Hungarians have discovered a bunch of discarded passports in the bushes on the border near Serbia. Apparently, a bunch of migrants have basically dumped their own passports and are pretending to be Syrian because Syrian refugees get asylum. The media reports it as economic migrants cheating their way into the EU for better economic opportunities. But we certainly can't ignore the very real national security risks represented by this phenomenon. Note that there are very few women and children actually pretending to be refugees or being refugees or whatever you want to call it. Most of them are Middle Eastern men. You don't find that weird or concerning?
It does seem a little odd that refugees are mostly men. That seems a little backwards.
Yes, Captain Obvious, it is. Fake passports can be obtained on the black market by terrorists. So, from what I'm reading, it's also really easy to do that. And with the world and some progs demanding that we take in thousands of these people, because we don't have enough issues on our border with Mexico, obviously, we could easily be allowing the next suicide bomber, or 100, to enter our country in the name of, well, compassion. Because all of those Middle Eastern men have to be needy refugees, right? And believe me, the photos of the dead children are just the beginning. They're tragic, but you know what? They're being used for a very specific reason. That's the downside of the 24-hour news cycle. It's so easy to just spread storm and drang until the people demand action. So that's what's going on here.
All right, Nikki. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
You bet. Take care.
Nikki blogs at thelibertyzone.com. Plug of the week. So I got a really exciting one for you.
Yeah? What'd you get?
A selfie stick.
I'm sorry, what?
A selfie stick.
You're one of those people? What is wrong with you?
Actually, I managed to find a way to turn the tool of narcissism into something that makes my life a little bit easier. Necessarily, I need to be a little bit circumspect in how I describe what I do for a living. I work for an insurance company, and for this insurance company, I do inspections on customer sites. That's as far as I'll go.
Okay.
I'm not going to tell you the company I work for. I'm not going to tell you the specific type of insurance or the type of inspections I do. But there are times when it's difficult to see what I need to see to do the inspection, and it's also a little bit difficult to get the photograph by just sort of waving my camera at it, you know, my cell phone. So what I found out was, is if I bought this $25 selfie stick, I could stick the cell phone where I needed to take the picture and punch the button on the end of the stick and boom, I had pictures.
Well, that's interesting.
There are times where I would have to hang upside down and stick my head into a confined space in order to get a view of something. It's very difficult to assess whether something's in good shape or not when you're upside down and all the blood's rushing to your eyeballs. But you take a picture and you blow it up. And you know, on the screen, you zoom in and you look it all over and it's great. It's wonderful. If you find yourself in one of those positions where you need to take pictures of something that's not really that easy for you to get to, or, you know, if you need to take a picture or video or something of something that, where you got a crowd in the way and you just want to hold a stick over your head and do it that way, this is the way to go. The entire thing shrinks down to about 6 or 7 inches long and fits in the cargo pocket of my cargo pants.
Well, all right.
So go to the show notes. There's a link. It's $25 for the best rated selfie stick, and I've used it. I love it. Well, he's back for another true story of adventure, this time from his youth in Western Africa. Law Dog tells us the story of Brigadier Captain Azakawi and Fido the Yard Frog. In this little segment, we like to call...
This One Time?
Born and raised in the wilds of Africa and the Middle East, Law Dog has been a Texas peace officer since 1993. Welcome to the show, Law Dog.
Thank you, Sean. Long time no see.
Well, Law Dog, I bet you've seen and done some unusual things in your time.
That can be an understatement. In Africa, we had this local named Brigadier Captain Azakiwi about half the year. And he was one of these annoying little gits who constantly has his finger up testing the breeze. No matter who was in power, whether it was the army or the civilian government, depending on the time of the year, Azakiwi had always been one of the most loyal subjects they had. Major lickspittle, complete toady, yes man. He had the prize for being just a total toad. Only convictions he's ever had were on his criminal record. I really disliked that man. He was tiny, very small man in a country where the tribesmen tend to be average height, if not more. And since he was tiny, he'd been picked on a lot, gave him a bit of a bully complex. But again, he was tiny, so he would pick on those who were smaller than him. Normally, that would be Chris and I, since I'd say we were 8 and 10, maybe, and not real big at that. Unfortunately, Dad was Chief Jim, the big boss of the plant, and a major source of revenue for a struggling army officer or junior minister of government, depending on who was in power that month. Truth be told, we really didn't give a damn, which kind of flustered him a bit. I always thought the fact that we didn't care was the reason he tolerated us. But Mom said it was because of the Fido lunch incident. Now, Fido, spelled P-H-Y-D-E-A-U-X, was our yard frog. And he was a West African giant frog. And if you've ever seen one of these things, it's basically frog-shaped, but about the size of a small terrier. They say they get to be about 5 pounds, and they lie. Fido was bloody huge. He was every bit the size of a basketball, with legs, and these big cue ball-sized eyes up top. He lived under a rock in one of Mom's flower beds and was responsible for outside varmint control. Anything that trundled up, Fido would eat. If he couldn't eat it, he'd sulk at it till it went away. Anyway, on the famous lunch incident day, Fido had found himself a small ball python. Ball pythons are named such because when they get upset, they curl themselves up into little balls, or big balls in this case. He decided that this was lunch. Python didn't think so. He had some rather firm opinions on the matter. And they wound up tussling in the yard to the point they got under the house. Now, under the house was a no-go zone for Fido. Fido did not belong under the house because he had this nasty habit. He'd get under there, he'd get lonely and start thinking of lady frogs and start singing the amphibian version of Henry VIII, I Am, I Am. In the early hours of the morning, and usually directly under Mom's pillow, Mom had stated that if Fido ever got in the house again and kept her awake all night, there was going to be frog jambalaya on the menu. So there's Fido. There's Ball Python. He's under the house. Chris and I, we like Fido, so we scoot under the house to get Fido out. Here's the Ball Python. He's rolled himself in a ball, you know, because that's what Ball Pythons do. Fortunately, when he was in a ball, he was a little bit bigger than Fido's mouth. And Fido had a large mouth, but a little bit bigger. So Fido was extremely frustrated. In his little amphibian mind, he was rolling this python around. If he could get one thumb in there, he was certain that he could turn it into snake spaghetti. But the python was having none of it. So we get in there. We get the snake and the frog separated. Fido gets a case of the butt about it and hops under a beam to sit there and sulk for a while. Chris decides that, okay, Fido is not going to come out of there as long as the snake's there because that's lunch. So he grabs a snake and he squirrels his way out from under the house, pops out, and there is Brigadier Captain Azakiwi. Absolutely, I mean, sun shining off the acres and acres of gilt and a crisp khaki uniform. There he is, come to pay his respects and, you know, gently hint that if there's some orphan bribe money laying around, he was more than happy to give a good home. Chris scoots out with his ball python. He's a perfectly good adult. Doesn't want to waste a snake. You know, we can do things with snakes, so... There's Azakiwi's hand out for the money. Chris grabs a snake, puts it in Azakiwi's hand. says, "Hold this," and scoots back under the house. All well and good. Unfortunately, and totally understandable on our part, I thought, was the last thing you'd expect to find in a West African native, you know, a dweller of the rainforest, is a snake phobia. Really kind of unexpected. So we're under there. Fido is being Fido. We finally get him under the house and discover that this person whom Chris has entrusted the snake has apparently decided to take a nap on the lawn. Okay, this is not really surprising. Mom and Dad had a great deal of friends we called the usual suspects, and they could be found in an identical state, usually Saturday morning, but usually they'd be on the carpet, not the front lawn. We didn't really, you know, adult passed out. Okay, it happens. Not a big deal, but we wanted our snake back. As a Kiwi wasn't waking up, so we started lifting and checking, you know, lifting, see if he's hiding under his arm, in his pockets, no snake. Roll him over a couple of times, the snake is not there, which is somewhat frustrating. So Chris got upset, pokes him until he wakes up and goes, "Oi, what about our snake?" As a Huey stares at him for a moment, looks at Chris, shrieks like a little girl, and makes hauls ash for the street. I mean, gone. Foop. Which, no big deal. I mean, he was, as a Huey, he's a pain in the ass. However, this led to major problems later on. We'd had a bit of an incident involving ammonium triiodide, which, for those of us who do not know, ammonium triiodide is a very unstable explosive. Our mother had taught us how to make it to keep us out of trouble.
Oh, Lord.
Allow you to wrap your minds around that for just now. And it led to a unfortunate incident involving the back steps and my father. Word of the wise, sapper lizard sounds a good idea, bad practice. After we picked up the pieces and scraped my dad off the lawn, our chemistry sets had disappeared, so no more ammonium triiodide. We'd been a little upset. So one of my father's engineer buddies had found us a book of medieval siege weaponry, which, as you can imagine, was extremely interesting to us. So we study it for a couple of days, and we build a trebuchet, which is a counterweight catapult. And we make it out of 2x4s and a bucket of concrete, and we're flinging croquet balls. It's about 4 feet, and we're getting, I'd say, good 50 feet with a croquet ball. It was beautiful. However, the usual suspects were at that stage of liquidity where good senses fled, but you're not yet proned out on the carpet. So they're watching us trebuchet, and they decide that we need some guidance, some advice, maybe a helping hand here and there. So, of course, they wound up taking over. This was fun, especially when somebody fired up an arc welder. The results were beautiful. The counterweight was drill pipe, a lot of drill pipe, a forklift load of drill pipe. The business arm was higher than the house rafters when unloaded, and it required a winch truck to get it into firing position. I mean, beautiful. When it was finally built, my mother, who was less intoxicated than everybody else, no, I did not say sober, merely less intoxicated, drove us about 100 yards to the scrap field behind my father's office, and we helped the adults stack up a whole bunch of empty 55-gallon drums, about 3 deep, to make Fortress, our Fortress of Fortitude. Mom, like I said, not quite sober, hung a tablecloth to be the flag. Drive back to the house, about 100 yards. Dad gets his prized 16-pound bowling ball out of the closet. Mom ceremoniously christens it by pouring a beer over it. We load it in the sling, and Tom, my father's British friend, smacks it with a sledgehammer. And it was magnificent. Nobody saw the arm move. I mean, one moment it's down, next moment it's standing straight up, and there's a tremendous crash as all this drill pipe hits the ground. Stand there vibrating, and this one engineer says, "Did it go?" Another one goes, "Oh, hell yes." Third one says, "I told you that the hook needed more hook." And first one said, "Well, it's going, isn't it?" Indubitable. The second guy says, "Well, it probably needed to go a little more," and he points kind of horizontally, "and less," and he points vertically, because words had done left him. So they're arguing back and forth, and then my father says, "Dear, did we bring the Range Rover back from the fortress building?" And Mom kind of waves the keys at him. Dad's Brit buddy Tom says, "Oh, who the hell is that then?" Another one says, "Oi, isn't that little sticky-fingered chappy, sneezy?" Somebody else goes, "As a Kiwi?" Third person goes, "Sure, tight." The usual stuff. Sure enough, down there in the middle of the company scrapyard, bearing in mind he had opened 2 gates to get there, locked gates, is bigger than a captain has a Kiwi, and it's a Nigerian Army-issued Range Rover. About parked about 20 feet away from our 55-gallon drum fort, he's up on the drums stealing my mother's tablecloth. Because that's what you do. So here he is. He's up there. He is liberating this perfectly good tablecloth out of the kindness of the heart, you understand. And we're looking at this, and my mother is losing her mind. I mean, he's stealing her tablecloth. And she is winding up for a full-on red-headed berserker rage when the Range Rover that he was driving just kind of settles on springs. And the window glass just sprays around my dad's office yard. The roof crumples up, and there's this wonderful baritone crump noise. And everybody looks at it and goes, ooh. Glasses clank off teeth. There's a general contemplative moment. And somebody says, skosh, you bit right, I think. A bit more than a skosh, old boy. Is that a military term? More hook to the hook. We take off. We're hauling butt over to the yard to get the bowling ball back because that's the only one we had. Didn't turn out to be too trivial to find because it was wedged in the seat, the driver's seat. Took a little prying to get it out, but wasn't hard to get to because both doors were laying in the dirt. It was wonderful. Turned it into a convertible and nothing flat. So we get it pried out. I'm looking around and I can't find Azakiwi. He is gone. The tablecloth is still there flooding the breeze. Azakiwi is gone. He's not at the top of the barrels. He's not at the bottom. He's nowhere. So we get the bowling ball. You know, screw it. We're heading back. I happen to look at a palm tree that was lining the edge of the office lot. And as a Kiwi is at the top of the palm tree, lost his hat, lost the corncob pipe, aviator glasses, nowhere to be seen. And it was the palest I've ever seen him. But it's definitely as a Kiwi. So we're looking at it. It's like, wow, you know, teleportation? Was it a dimensional gate? How did he get from here? And we notice he is screaming at the top of his lungs, but he's so angry. His voice has gone up in pitch to the point that only dogs would have been able to hear it, I think. And the only thing we can hear is, bad juju! Bad juju! Devil children! And he is losing his mind. So we figure, okay, this is obviously one of those adult situations that mom and dad told us about that we didn't need to worry about, and that probably we need to find an adult. We take our bowling ball, we go back to tell the adults there's a situation here, and we find that they're loading beer cans into my mother's wicker laundry hamper, which is on the sling, which doesn't sound too bad until you remember that in the early 70s, beer cans were made of steel. Yes, and they're giggling. So one of the engineers says, where's Azakiwi? Well, Jerry, I think he's in that palm tree. No problem. They start moving things. My father grabs me and my brother and says, you need to step out of the way, because they slew the entire thing about 5 degrees. Tom hits the release, and they center mast the top of that palm tree with 2 weeks worth of steel beer cans. As a Kiwi comes out of there like he's just been hit with a cricket bat. Hits the ground, jumps up, shrieking at the top of his lungs, and he begins to retreat under fire. I mean, hauling butt and leaving his Army-issued Range Rover to our victorious hands. Dad hung on to that thing for about 6 weeks, made them do all sorts of negotiation before he got it back. Yet somehow, this was Chris and my fault. And somehow, in Isaac Huey's hurling mind, we were responsible for this, which led to the honey badger in the pit, but that's a story for later time.
Can't wait. All right, Law Dog, it was good to talk with you. I'll see you again soon.
Bye-bye.
Read more from The Law Dog at thelawdogfiles.blogspot.com.
Fido the Yard Frog.
Wait until I play the story that he told me that I couldn't use last time that was 22 minutes long. Oh my goodness.
Oh man.
Fun with headlines.
So this one I saw, you saw, Aaron saw, and sent to you and me, and somebody else pointed out to you, hey, maybe this is a good fun with headlines. Florida teen kills masked intruder who turns out to be his dad.
Oh, man. Shot his own dad?
Yeah.
That's why we can't have kids with guns. We've got to take them out of the houses. People get shot by mistake.
Right, right. Dad was just, what, like going to the bathroom in the middle of the night?
And, right. You know, had a couple beers, came him. Home. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. How about no? A St. Petersburg teen is back home after he tells News Channel 8 that he shot and killed an intruder who turned out to be his father. Malachi Heisler tells us he woke up to cries for help early Tuesday morning. I woke up to my name being called, okay? I heard the words Malachi and help, and that's all I heard when I woke up, said Heisler in front of his home. He pointed it at my mother first, and then I came out of the room and he pointed it at me. So picture in your head, it was a standoff between me and him. He had his pistol and I had my rifle. It doesn't matter, a bullet is a bullet, one shot, you're dead, explained Heisler. Heisler, 18, said he was in the home with his mother, her boyfriend, and his younger sister. He said he only had seconds to make a decision and didn't know who the man was that he shot until after the gun was fired. Heisler tells us he recognized his father by tattoos and physical characteristics. Think of it as a SWAT getup. You see what SWAT members wear? Think that, except without a helmet. It was a ski mask, said Heisler about what his father was wearing. Heisler tells News Channel 8 he was questioned for hours by detectives Tuesday morning. At first it felt like I made the wrong decision. That's how they made me feel. At first it felt like I made the complete wrong decision. Everybody was raised voices, canine units, guns pointed at me. Heisler tells News Channel 8 that his mother had a restraining order against his father after he was arrested at their home in April of 2015. It's September of 2015 now, and charged with felon in possession of firearms. I had a feeling that something like this would happen, but I didn't know when, said Heisler, who is convinced his father was there to kill him. He wanted to scare us first, and then kill us while we were afraid. Heisler was released after hours of questioning Tuesday morning. He wasn't a good dad, no Father of the Year awards, said Heisler finally. So this is more like, teenager defends his mother from crazy.
Felon with gun.
Yeah.
Father.
Yeah.
You know what? He took out the trash.
Yeah.
I noticed that I'm coming pretty close to filling up the memory chip on the Zoom H6 recorder we use to record the podcast whenever we do the main show. So Baron gives me some suggestions in...
Tech tips.
Tech tips. Tech tips.
You are damaging my calm.
Tech tips with the Baron.
Baron, I'm loving this new Zoom H6 recorder that I've been using for the last, 10 or 15 podcasts. The problem is that it shipped with a 2 GB SD card. I need something bigger, but there's so many choices. How do I choose?
Well, there's two things you need to worry about, Sean. Capacity and speed. Let's start with capacity. Older devices will not recognize cards over 2 or 4 GB in size. This is a limitation due to the software and file system. There are just too many bits for the device to deal with, so it doesn't recognize all of the card. You will find SD cards in the following capacity sizes. SD, that's standard plain Jane, 0 to 2 GB in size, will work with anything. FAT12 and FAT16 are the common file systems. You have SDHC, otherwise known as high capacity, which are 2 GB to 32 GB, uses FAT32 for the file system. Then we have SDXC, otherwise known as extreme capacity, and they go from 32 GB to 2 TB, and this uses something called EXFAT. So, now let's talk performance. There are currently 6 classes of performance, ranging from 2 MB per second on the low end to 30 MB per second on the high end. The two fastest standards right now are UHS-1 and UHS-2. UHS-1 matches the older standard high-end class of 10, and the speed of that is 10 MB per second. This covers your standard HD video, though 4K and 2K video need to use the newer standard of UHS-2 and will actually operate at about 30 MB per second. The thing about speed is the faster it is, the less time it takes to write a chunk of data to the card. The quicker it is, the less internal buffer required while writing, and everything is just going to run better. This is also true for taking everything off the card. So, for example, dropping a UHS-2 card in my still camera is total overkill for taking still pictures. However, when taking strings of pictures, the camera itself will become the choke point, and when I go to pull the pictures off my card later, it will go considerably faster. So, for your recorder question, what size cards does it support?
Up to 128 gigs.
So, truthfully, you can run any capacity that is available. So, capacity is no longer even a question. The only real question we have is speed. And, well, it's an audio recorder. And even with 6 channels running full bore at the maximum sampling rates, you're only looking at maybe 0.5 MB per second, which is actually below the lowest class rating for SD cards. So you don't have to get a super fast, expensive card, or a super large one, depending on what you want to do for record times. So, how much data are you siphoning off when you're done?
About a gig, 1.2, 1.3 gigs.
At 10 MB per second, that'll take you right about 2 minutes to actually get off the card. That's not that bad. You could go get a UHS 2 card, but it would be considerably more expensive because the requirements are high enough that supply and demand, there's considerably fewer of them, so they charge a premium for it. But a UHS 1 or a Class 10 device should be more than enough, and you can pick up a 32 gigabyte card for $14.
All right, Baron. It was good to talk with you. See you again soon.
See you next week, Sean.
Baron still blogs at the-minuteman.org. The J-Block.
So, I did another Appleseed.
Woo! How'd you do?
I had equipment failure again. But we'll talk about that in a minute. So, this is my second Appleseed. First time I went was with Linoge back in 2012, I think. Anyway, it was a while ago. Interestingly enough, one of the people that went with us was a reader named Lyndon, who is now an instructor with Appleseed.
Woohoo!
And was actually the line boss at this particular Appleseed shoot.
Cool.
So that was kind of cool. Claude was the shoot boss. Claude looks like Santa Claus. and a thin Santa Claus. He's a really awesome guy. You actually met him at the NRA convention.
Yes, I remember him.
And then the other instructors were Ben, Greg, Doyle, Navy Doc. I didn't actually catch his real name. And Tejas Lady, and I didn't actually catch her real name either. It was a good time. I took my nephew and his father, my wife's brother, and we had a real good time. Both days got rained out at about 3:00. So that was a little disheartening. And we only shot about 4 or 5 AQTs because of that, as opposed to the 8 or 9 I felt like I shot last time. But we had, I think, 15 or 17 people show up, and two folks made riflemen. Grant, who shot a 230 on the first AQT.
Good.
Which was pretty good.
Yeah.
250 is the maximum.
Yeah, 230 is pretty high up there.
Yeah. Shot with iron sights and a borrowed rifle. So he is a an NCO with the U.S. Army. So I don't know if that had anything to do with it. And then the other guy who made riflemen was Alex, who shot a 211, also regular Army.
211. 210 is a qualifier, right?
210 is a qualifier, and Claude said that if you actually shoot a 210, they dump water on you.
Well, you're not on that list.
No, I'm not on that list. Now, people who listen to the podcast regularly or read the blog when I was blogging will know that the first time I went, I had a problem because I was shooting an M&P 1522. It was one of the first ones that was made. It has a plastic upper receiver, and as the rifle warmed up during the day, the plastic upper receiver flexed and shifted my point of aim, point of impact. I can blame the rifle for that, right? So that's why I didn't make riflemen the first time. This time, I actually cleaned both redcoats on Sunday. That's 13 rounds, and there's 3 at the 100 yard, 3 at the 200, 3 at the 300, 3 at the 400, and then 1 in the what they call the shingle, which is a slightly smaller than 1x1 square.
It's a head box.
Yes. You know, I hit all of them both times. Here's the problem. The only reason I was able to do that is because I was able to adjust my point of aim for my point of impact on the 100-yard target. What was happening was the receiver in my 1022 was moving around in the stock. So that first 2 or 3 rounds of every single string was moving the receiver, basically setting it into a good position. And I couldn't fix it. In fact, I tried to fix it by tightening down the screw and shifted it 14 MOA to the left, tightened it down again and shifted 7 MOA to the right. Now, the very last AQT that I shot, I actually used Lyndon's rifle. He let me borrow it, which was awesome, except I shot the guy's target next to me on the first go around.
So he did really, really good.
Yeah, he did really well.
Double the number of holes.
Yes, got 20 holes in the 10 round target.
Yeah,
and that was the last AQT of the whole clinic. So it was just kind of, well, that's it. So I get to go back again, which will be fine.
You can come out here and borrow my rifle. I qualified with a 232 and a pair of 225s, so I know it works.
See, my problem is that I've been trying to get fancy, right? Oh, look, I'm going to shoot an AR-22 clone. Yeah, it didn't work out. Oh, look, I'm going to get a 10-22 this time, right? 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 So I'm going to get the takedown tactical. No, I'm just going to go buy a 1022.
I still need to save up a couple of bucks because I still want that Magpul 1022 stock.
That is pretty awesome.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Because it would put my wrist in a more natural position while I'm shooting.
Yeah.
I love that stock. So, Magpul, if you're listening, Sean at SeanSorrentino.com.
Ruger, if you're listening.
Yeah.
Send me a 1022.
Yeah, Ruger. If you want to give your rifle to somebody who doesn't know what he's doing with it. And now, a word from our sponsor. You know what will happen. If you ever have to defend yourself, you're going to end up in handcuffs. Are you trained to win the fight after the fight? Sure, you can draw, aim, and put two in the 10 ring, but have you learned your legal self-defense? Do you know the law? Go to lawofselfdefense.com/variety to sign up for your legal self-defense class. Each class is tailored to the laws in your state. Attorney Andrew Branca will teach you the law. Not just what the law says, but what the judge's legal opinions say. What the jury instructions say. Sure, you could risk spending the rest of your life in prison because you followed the advice of some gun store counter jockey, or you could spend the day with the man who literally wrote the book on the law of self-defense. Carry a gun so you're hard to kill. Know the law so you're hard to convict. Go to lawofselfdefense.com/variety to sign up for a legal self-defense class in your state. And make sure to use discount code VARIETY at checkout to receive 10% off. Now, I know that I make fun of gun store counter jockeys, and taking advice from gun store counter jockeys is usually a bad idea. If you happen to live in Indianapolis, you can go to Indy Arms Company, their grand opening was a couple of days ago, and look for the relatively tall redhead. If she tells you something, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's our favorite gun blogger, Tam. So if you live in Indianapolis, go to Indy Arms Company, say hi to Tam, and tell her that Sean and Adam say hi. Well, the anti-gunners are lying again.
Again?
Well, still, really. Weird catches them in another lie in
This Week in Anti-Gun Nuttery.
So, hey, Weird, how's it going this week?
It's going good, Sean. So, Bloomberg's digging up the old big lie with the Iron Pipeline. The myth where criminals acquire guns in states that adhere to the U.S. Constitution and traffic them to locations where the right to keep and bear arms isn't recognized. So, from Michael Bloomberg's The Trace... Imagine the United States is an apartment building with a cockroach problem. Some residents, unsettled by the creatures, hire exterminators to end the infestation in their units. Others, however, are ideologically opposed to pesticides and refuse to take action. In the near term, a portion of the roaches die off, but in an untreated part of the building, the colonies multiply. One morning, the guy who paid the exterminator $200 wakes up with a roach on his forehead and sees several more crawling along the baseboards of his bedroom.
Cool story, bro, but... how do you tie it to guns?
So now the story continues. Gun rights advocates often challenge the efficacy of firearms restrictions by pointing to, say, Chicago, Illinois, which has both an intensely prohibitive laws and exorbitantly high rates of gun violence. But it's not the local laws that don't work, O'Keefe says. It's that gun laws in general are far less effective when they're uneven. Chicago is less than an hour from Indiana, which, with its loose regulations, supplies the city with a great deal of firepower. The roaches, in other words, are simply coming from another part of the building.
But they're totally not degrading us and slyly calling for our extermination. As a gun owner, I sure love being compared to a cockroach.
So the roach analogy is cool. Let's ignore the blatant dehumanization and look just at the logic. If some people hold out in exterminating pests, there will always be a brood stock for the next infestation. One problem. The apartments that don't spray are infested with roaches at all times during this analogy. So if the gun equals the cockroach, you'd think that places with lax gun laws who refuse to call the exterminators on gun owners, roaches, would have terrible gun crime, right? In reality, the places with more relaxed gun laws have lower crime than the restrictive areas. If criminals were flogging the lax gun law states to get illicit guns, do you think they might commit crimes there too? Or maybe there could be a reason why they are so well behaved when any man or woman on the street might be armed.
Or is the problem that their homegrown criminal cockroaches cause problems for them in their own home, and instead of spraying and setting up some really secure roach motels, they're desperately trying to blame the rest of us.
Hey Sean, let's play a game. Welcome to the Bloomberg is Right, the game show where the ordinary people find out how false the propaganda really is. Let's get started. 100 ATF statisticians surveyed. Top three answers on the board. How do criminals get their guns?
They buy guns in states with lax gun laws and drive them up the iron pipeline.
Sorry, Sean, but if the criminals are traveling out of their high crime home state to buy guns, don't you think they'd be committing crimes there too? Plus, they'd have to show ID, fill out 4473s, and generally follow the law. And we know that they just don't do that, don't we? If the criminals were on their best behavior because the populace is armed, well, the filthy NRA would be right.
They buy them at gun shows where there's no background checks.
Sorry, Sean, but criminals surveyed in prison openly state that they don't get their guns from gun shows.
They buy guns on the internet like gun brokers with no background checks.
I'm sorry, Sean, but you've lost. But here are some lovely parting gifts. So let's have a look at the images on Bloomberg's own page. They reference Illinois, New York, California, and my home state of Massachusetts. So we do see a bunch of traces from outside states. But what's the biggest supplier in all three? Texas? Georgia? Vermont?
Vermont, because they don't have any gun laws at all.
Most guns come from within their own home state. Also, go ahead and look at the full ATF figures. They have a term called time to crime. In the states cited, the time ranges from 13 to 16 years. Even the national average is 10 years. This means that if there are illegal straw buyers, they are acquiring guns in foreign states and then simply sitting on them for over a decade before selling them. That make any sense to you?
Not really.
So where do criminals get their guns from? Here's a study that interviewed violent criminals. It said, it's rare for offenders to buy from licensed dealers, and also rare for them to steal their guns. Rather, the predominant source of guns to offenders are family, acquaintances, and fellow gang members, which is to say, members of their social network. So you know exactly what the pro-gun side has been saying all along.
All right, Weird. It was good to talk with you. See you again soon.
Talk to you next week, Sean.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host at The Squirrel Report and blogs at WeirdWorld.com. That's WeirdWorld.com.
Okay, so nobody told me there was going to be a game show. That was awesome.
Blame Weird on that one. He won. Let's do another skit, Sean. Let's do another skit. We're like, all right, sure. Stuff that grinds my gears. AT record setter settles with Katadin Narcs over champagne incident. Now, you know what the Appalachian Trail is, right?
Yes.
Pretty much. Everybody knows what the Appalachian Trail is.
Yes.
The Appalachian Trail is a walking trail that goes from someplace in Georgia to Mount Katahdin, I'm probably not pronouncing that correct, in Maine. Apparently, there's a breed of people who think it's a whole lot of fun to see how fast they can get from one end to the other.
Take anything and somebody will make it a contest.
Well, this is the story of the guy who currently holds the record. Jurek celebrated his finish atop Mount Katahdin, the northern terminus of the Appalachian Trail, by spraying and drinking champagne and celebrating with a group of people that grew to roughly 50, including his friends, supporters, media, and others on their own summit trips who joined him as he kissed the summit sign and his wife Jenny, who acted as his constant support staff for the entire mission. But despite Jurek's heroic finish and razor-thin record margin, the grizzled Narcs of Baxter State Park were unshakable, slapping the record breaker with citations for breaking multiple park rules, including drinking, littering, and bringing a group larger than 12 to the summit. The littering citation was even petty enough to be directed entirely at Jurek's spraying of champagne, which park officials described as leaving the summit smelling like a redemption center. Now, Maine is one of the few states where you can redeem recyclable bottles for cash at, you guessed it, a redemption center, according to Bangor Daily News. So, dude does the complete Appalachian Trail, and he did it in 46 days, 8 hours and some change.
Beat the previous record by like 3 hours.
3 hours and 13 minutes over a 2,189-mile trail, averaging 50 miles a day, with his poor wife following along behind him. And I have a wife, I know how far this would fly with her. And he breaks out the champagne, shakes it, sprays it, has a drink of it, and he's getting fined for drinking in a state park and littering because the champagne hit the ground on the top of a mountain.
Yeah, so I'm pretty much a the rules are the rules kind of guy, right? Because selective enforcement of the law is tyranny. But I can't really fault the guy for wanting to celebrate beating the world record for, you know, walking the Appalachian Trail, because that's a pretty big deal, right? So the whole, okay, more than 12 people came to the summit, whatever. All right, fine. I'll pay the fine. The, oh, well, you were drinking in the park. Whatever. Okay, fine. I'll pay the fine. I don't care. This is like the biggest day of my life. I'm going to talk about this for the rest of my life. My grandkids are going to tell this story, okay? It's going to be awesome.
Right.
Littering because you sprayed champagne all over the site. No, I'm sorry. I'm fighting that one. No, that's dumb.
Eventually, everybody came to their senses, and he was allowed to plead guilty to drinking in a state park and was charged a $500 fine, and that was the end of it. And his statement was, in the resulting plea bargain, Jurek had to admit to bringing booze to Katahdin's Peak, and in exchange was hit only with the drinking citation and a $500 fine. I drank champagne after a 46-day life-changing journey in the woods, Jurek wrote in his Facebook page, and it was the best $500 I ever spent. How freaking petty can they be? So, Adam, what's grinding your gears this week?
Rifles that don't work.
You know, they say a poor workman blames his tools.
Yeah, but okay, the receiver is moving around in the stock.
Did you not notice that it was doing this before you took it there?
No, because the first time I took this out and noticed that I was having point of impact problems, it was because the scope wasn't mounted properly. How was I to know that I had a multiple cascading failure situation going on here? And this is the third rifle that this has happened to? I mean, come on. Okay, yes. You know what? It's me. It's got to be me. What's common here? What's common here? There's a Ruger, there's a Remington, and a Smith & Wesson.
And an Adam.
All three... And an Adam. You know, it's got to be me.
I think maybe you should just give all your firearms to me.
No.
I'll get you a shotgun.
I think maybe I should just, like, bite the bullet and, like, take my stuff to a gunsmith to have them tighten the screws on scopes. Because apparently I can't do that right. And even if I do that right, then, oh, look, I bought a rifle. That receiver moves up and down about an eighth of an inch inside the stock.
Wow. Okay. I'd be having a chat with Ruger. Is that who made that?
Yeah. So, yeah. It's a short work week, so I had a lot of other stuff to do, and it's kind of low on the totem pole. But, you know, 10/22 takedown, not really meant for precision rifle work.
Dude, 14 minutes of angle?
Yeah, that was kind of bad.
That's not a precision problem. That's a broadside of the barn problem.
That is also true.
Yeah. Well, Weird had something for you.
Hi, my name's Adam from Guns, Cars, Tech Blog. My cars are old. My guns are considerably newer.
Yeah, apparently your cars work, though.
That never gets old.
Well, that's our show for the week. Thanks again to Rob Allen for our music, and thank you for listening to the Gun Blog Variety Cast. Constructive criticism can be sent to Sean at SeanSorrentino.com and hate mail to WizardPC at GunsCarsTech.com. And come on now, get some hate mail. WizardPC at GunsCarsTech.com. Send it in. Like and share us on Facebook. And if you receive this podcast through iTunes, make sure to leave us a glowing 5-star review. Show notes can be found at gunblogvarietycast.com/episode56. Dateline Charlotte, North Carolina. A man came home at about Wednesday. That doesn't make any sense at all. To find two people inside his home. East home? Who the fuck wrote this? A man came home Wednesday to find two people inside his home and shot them, Charlotte Mecklenburg police said in a news release.
But there is the other factor, and that is pulling everything off when you're done. So the question is, how much data are you sucking off when you're done?
You do not say sucking off in my podcast.
Praising.
This is a special for Awelawent. I posted something on Facebook about the super deal on the Kindle version of The Martian, and he said he started reading it at 3 a.m. and now it's like 6 a.m. and, you know, maybe he should get some sleep today. He went on to say that for some reason the narrator's voice came across to him as weird. So, Awelawent, this one's for you.
Log entry, Sol 6. I'm pretty much f***ed. That's my considered opinion. F***ed. 6 days into what should be the greatest 2 months of my life, and it's turned into a nightmare. I don't even know who will read this. I guess someone will find it eventually, maybe 100 years from now. For the record, I didn't die on Sol 6. Certainly the rest of the crew thought I did, and I can't blame them. Maybe there'll be a day of national mourning for me, and my Wikipedia page will say Mark Watney is the only human being to have died on Mars. And it'll be right, probably. Because surely I'll die here, just not on Sol 6 where everyone thinks I did. Let's see. Where do I begin? The Ares program. Mankind reaching out to Mars to send people to another planet for the very first time and expand the horizons of humanity. Blah, blah, blah. The Ares 1 crew did their thing and came back heroes. They got the parade, the fame, the love of the world. Ares 2 did the same thing, in a different location on Mars. They got a firm handshake and a hot cup of coffee when they got home. Ares 3, well, that was my mission. Okay, not mine per se. Commander Lewis was in charge. I was just one of the crew. Actually, I was the very lowest ranked member of the crew. I would only be in command of the mission if I were the only remaining person. What do you know? I'm in command. I wonder if this log will be recovered before the rest of the crew die of old age. I presume they got back to Earth all right. Guys, if you're reading this, it wasn't your fault.
That was chapter 1 of The Martian by Andy Weir, as read by Weird. Link for it in the show notes. I loved it. Awelawent obviously loved it. Hit the show notes for the link and buy yourself a copy.